May it please the court.
You may proceed.
It is uncontested in the present case that Mr. Brooks stole money from the Regions Bank in St. Charles. The only question in this case is whether Mr. Brooks used or threatened the immediate use of force when he stole money from the bank. Now, before discussing the facts of the case, I would like to begin by discussing really the law of the case and what the state has to prove to show a threat of the immediate use of force. An issue has emerged during briefing in this case, and then it was also an issue in State v. Coleman, the Western District case that was released yesterday, that they have now transferred to this court. So it's an issue in those cases, and that is when looking at whether a threat of force was used, should courts look to the actions of the defendant, or should they look to the subjective reactions of the victim? And the state cites the State v. Rounds, an Eastern District case from 1990, for the proposition that the force necessary to constitute robbery may consist of putting the victim in fear. However, I cited to a Western District case in my initial brief and my reply brief, State v. Tivis. The Western District in that case specifically rejected the state's argument that placing a person in fear of injury was sufficient to establish the offense of robbery. And I believe this conflict arose because of a change in the robbery statute. The robbery statute was amended in 1979, and it hasn't been amended since that I can tell. But the old statute said that a person was guilty of robbery, and that was in the first degree, but now it's the second. But a person was guilty of robbery if the person takes the property from another person, and list a few other elements, but one of them is by putting him in fear of some immediate injury to his person. So putting them in fear was an element of the old statute, and certainly taking Ms. Ebau's reactions in this case, the victim in this case, it would be appropriate under that old statute. The new statute, though, says that a person forcibly steals and thereby commits robbery when in the course of stealing he uses or threatens the immediate use of physical force. So I believe
What about this slamming of the hand down and saying, get back here?
Well,
why isn't that enough?
Because a slamming of the hand in this context was to get the victim's attention. So I acknowledge if I am looking at a person and I'm directly in front of them and I slam my hand, I can see how that could be a threat. But if a person is turning away from me and I slam my hand, it's to get their attention.
That's how you interpret.
I think that in the light most favorable is how it can be interpreted, as well as the victim. That's how she interpreted it.
Well, what about the get back here? Is that like get back here or else, or do you have to say or else? Or
I think you would have to say or else. It said get back here. The victim testified she interpreted that action as getting her attention. She testified to that twice.
Well, she
she's
also
not
testified.
Testifying the victim. The bank is the victim.
Well, she's named in the information, so that's why I'm saying the victim.
But she testified she was afraid, and she was afraid to go into the bank and other things. So clearly she was put in fear. She didn't just... So something about what he did caused her to feel threatened.
So I acknowledge that she was put in fear in the situation.
But you're
she
saying
testified
the
that
jury
the
could not find the slam and say, get back here, was the cause of it?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, and I don't think she testified that was the cause of it. She testified that she was put in fear, but she didn't say the hand slap is what caused that fear.
Did she say what did cause the fear?
I don't believe so.
So what about if you pass a note to the cashier and say, I have a gub?
I have a gun? Is that what you said?
No, not a gun. A gub. It was like, it was hard.
There was
to
a case
he,
for that.
He didn't have good handwriting, so he says, I have a gub. But he meant to say, I have a gun.
Well, I think if the victim thought that he meant gun, possibly, but that's certainly not this situation. There's no allegation the note in this case mentioned a gun.
If he had waited till the teller turned around and used his elastic reach to reach over and take the money out and no one saw him do it, I might be a little more sympathetic, but he had no right to the money he was asking for. The teller knew that. He knew that. and he was compelling her to give him money everyone knew he had no right to. Why isn't that itself a threatened use of force?
Well, you used the word compelled her. I would use the word coerced her. And stealing by coercion is stealing, 570.030. And that was addressed by the majority opinion in Coleman yesterday, that there's a difference between coercion and actually taking the affirmative action of threatening the immediate use of force. So you have to look at his actions.
But coercion is a threat, right? I mean, that connotes a threat. It's a threat of what? If force, then you have...
Well, I don't know that it necessarily connotes a threat of the immediate use of force.
No, I'm not. But it's a threat of something. Coercion is compelling someone by a threat of something. And if it's force, then it would be this crime. If it was something else, it might be stealing by coercion.
Well, but here, none of the actions were actually communicating a threat.
And in fact, the legislature used the word immediate. And so we assume immediate has some import in determining what they intended. So it's not that any robbery, when you're coercing someone to give you money, falls within the definition of uses or threatens the use of immediate force.
Yes, you're right, Honor. You're right, Your Honor. And I think that goes back to State v. Carter, the Eastern District case, and that's one of the cases I'm relying on, where it was out on the street, not in a bank, or by the victim's car, and he said, "Give me your purse." And she said, "You can..." Told them to get it out of her coat pocket. The defendant did that. He got the money. He ran away. So I don't see a distinction between that case and this case, where you're both demanding money, essentially, from a victim.
You said we don't look at the point of view of the victim, because under the new statute, is it an objective test as to whether a reasonable person would believe there was a threat of the immediate use of physical force, or are you saying it's his subjective point of view, or what point of view are you saying we should?
I think you have to look at the defendant's actions to determine whether any reasonable juror could determine beyond a reasonable doubt that his actions constitute. It's really, yes, it's an objective test of whether the evidence shows he intended to use or intended to threaten the use of force.
What about, was there, other than the teller that you spoke of, was there another bank employee who overheard when the guy raised his voice?
Yes.
Okay, what about that? The fact that the comment was so loud that not just the person he was dealing with overheard him slam the table and said, "Get back here."
Well, I'm pretty sure the testimony was that it was the next teller over, so I don't think that teller was very far away. But I don't think that teller also didn't testify that she believed there was any threat of the use of force. So I don't think her testimony can be shown. Can be used to show that Mr. Brooks actually communicated a threat of force.
Well, the way I understand your argument, even if she did testify to that, you say it doesn't matter.
Well, so it depends on how you interpret his actions. So the slamming of the hand, the fact that the victim was turning around, I think whether there's any evidence to contradict that under our standard of review, that would matter. But I think it goes to what the defendant actually did. So it doesn't matter how the victim feels, but it matters as to what the...
Well, doesn't it matter how the reasonable victim would feel? That's what I'm trying to get to you. Is it what a reasonable robber would intend, or what a reasonable victim would feel, or as opposed to the subjective view of that particular victim?
Well, I think it's really based on the defendant's actions. And I think if a reasonable person would not feel threatened, I think it cannot be a robbery. But I think in the real question, though, is would these actions constitute a threat of force?
It's a jury determination, wouldn't it be? And what if the robber was a very imposing figure and said, would you please give me your money? Very nicely. Those circumstances would still be in front of the jury to decide that, wouldn't it?
Well, in that situation, I don't think there was a threat of force in that situation. And I think that's what it comes down to.
Let me ask a question. Under your view, the statute, does the threat have to be expressed or can it be implied?
I think it can be implied, but I think it has to be a strong implication. I think putting your hand in your pocket and showing that you have a gun is really what's necessary. That nothing that the defendant did here rose to the level of an implied threat.
But could you also look at, when you're looking at the defendant's actions, should you consider how the defendant's dressed? In this case, the defendant was in a costume of disguise. The words the defendant used and the types of bills that the defendant demanded from the teller, maybe the defendant is even dressed in like armor gear or something. Don't those all go to the totality of the circumstances when we look at the defendant's actions?
I think armored gear might, because
that here, might. But a disguise, but, too. That's not just a person coming in normal on-the-street clothes.
But a disguise is only used to conceal your identity.
And so doesn't that indicate...
Well, it indicates he's maybe going to commit a crime, but it doesn't indicate he's going to threaten the use of force.
The issue in Coleman was whether he had to purposefully,
yes,
that is, acting for the purpose and the conscious objective of conveying a threat,
yes,
or whether he only had to knowingly convey a threat. Are you making that argument, or are you only arguing that this is not to be determined from the defendant's point of view, or from the victim's point of view?
Well, I'm actually arguing both. Can I take just a second to
Because
answer?
They're very different. So address that issue.
Well, the dissent in Coleman determined that there actually was not a mental state for the threat element, and they used 562.021.2 to reach that conclusion. The robbery statute 569.030 says that a person commits the crime of robbery in the second degree when he forcibly steals property. Under 562.021.3, since there's no mental element there or mental state, you would apply that knowingly or purposefully to every element. What the dissent did was they looked at the definition of forcibly steals. The definition of forcibly steals cites to the stealing statute. And because the stealing statute contains a mental state, they went to 562.021.2 and said none of the elements then of robbery had a mental state. Now, I think this court's opinion of State v. Williams contradicts that notion. State v. Williams, 126 Southwest 3rd, 377, and of this court from 2004, where this court looked at the Armed Criminal Action Statute and overruled a Western District case. The Western District had looked at the Armed Criminal Action Statute, said there's no mental state there, but then the Armed Criminal Action Statute refers to the other crime. And so the Western District looked at that other crime. There was a mental element. So they said, so there doesn't have to be a mental state for the armed criminal action because the underlying crime has one. And this court overturned that. I think this is the exact situation here. So I think the state does have to show that knowingly purposeful for each element in the robbery statute, including the threatened use of force.
Counselor. Your previous example, you said, well, what would be enough is if you act like you had a gun, but if that was part of it, that'd be first-degree robbery, right? That's the difference between first and second degree.
No, first degree actually requires you to have a gun, as far as I know.
I think presence or suggestion of a weapon.
Okay, then.
I
guess I was looking at State v. Liebarger, where a defendant did that and was convicted of, I believe, second-degree robbery. That's what I was basing that off of, was the State v. Liebarger case cited.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have some time on rebuttal.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Under this court's deferential standard of review, the fact finder in this case, which was a trial judge, could have found that the appellant implicitly threatened the immediate use of physical force under a totality of circumstances. In fact, the appellant here carefully crafted his actions so that the bank teller would feel the threat of immediate physical force if she did not comply. As the court's well versed in the facts, of course, the appellant disguised his identity, did not present an identification automatically.
What does that have to do with force?
Under the totality of circumstances, Your Honor, it sort of sets the stage. Here, he's wearing a disguise. This is not a normal transaction.
Right. So that means he's coming in to steal property. How does that threaten the use of force?
Not in and of itself, Your Honor. Followed by the note, and again, this court has to look at all the elements, what the finder of fact was presented with. He handed a note that was very specific, and in fact, the fact finder could determine from that he possessed the specific knowledge about the workings of the bank.
Which has nothing to do with whether or not he's using force.
It showed that he had the purpose to take this money.
Right.
And again, at that point, we're still setting the stage. This is not all the evidence. What removed any doubt was when the teller was either, her testimony was that she had to get more money from a window, I believe it was a drive-up window, and she turned away. He used a physical act, not on her, but on the counter, a hand slam that removed any doubt that there was a threat of physical force should she not comply with his
action. But she said she didn't interpret that as a threat of physical force.
Well, again, I think the finder of fact could, may or may not believe, you know, that if we're looking at her subjective belief, and there's been much discussion about whether a victim feels fear, whether that's even relevant. And in this case, of course, her opinion as to what his intention was
that's certainly relevant evidence as to the kind of slap it was, the noise it made, if it was unusual or if it was simply...
Well, she certainly testified she was in fear throughout.
But tell me how, and I understand your argument, but tell me how, implicit in every robbery is that I want your money. It's not like you're going to say, sure, anybody else wants some, that you feel some compulsion to give them the money. So there's some sort of threat implicit in the very nature of robbery itself, and yet the law distinguishes between the threat of use of immediate use of physical force versus just the threat of robbery itself. So how do we draw that distinction? What evidence is necessary to place it in one or the other?
Well, if I may, there was some talk earlier about regarding stealing, and stealing can be accomplished through deceit or coercion. And the statute 570.010, the chapter definitions, 570.010 sub 3b, coercion means a threat, however communicated, to inflict physical injury in the future on the person threatened or another. Distinction with robbery in the second degree, that would be accomplished by the threat of the immediate use of physical force.
But here, the slim, distinguish for me the difference between the threat implicit in saying, I'm going to take this money if you don't give it to me, versus the threat of immediate use of physical force. Because it seems like the threat of I'm going to take this money is implicit in saying, give me your money when it's not my money. And how does the hand slap go to immediate use of physical force as opposed to give me that money, I'm going to take it, versus harming you? This seems to be the key distinction between these two different levels of the crime.
Your Honor, if I understand the question, and under the facts in this case, and of course, robbery can be accomplished through either taking the item or compelling someone to surrender it. In this case, I think it's clear that he was dependent on compelling these bank employees, one in particular, to surrender the property. The hand slam, which was followed by, whether it was a yell or a shout, it may have been modulated, so obviously he wasn't going to want to attract too much attention. That's where the disguise, I think, comes into effect.
Would the hand slap attract attention?
Well, I think the yell also emphasized that. He was intent on forcing her to comply with his demands. And the hand slap, his hand slapping the counter, as well as the yell, could be reasonable, could create a reasonable inference that he was threatening the immediate use of physical force if she did not comply.
And see, that's my question. Assuming he was trying to compel her to comply, does that necessarily include then an immediate threat of use of physical force? So every time you forcibly or gruffly say...
I think the implication is that you're acquiescing to my demands to some extent. She's getting money. She's diverging a little bit by moving in a direction. He was trying to get her back on track. A physically, really a violent act on the counter, along with a yell. The reasonable inference is this, what would follow would be physical force if you did not comply with these demands.
Did she have a panic button or anything like that? What did she do besides give him the money?
She gave him the money and he left quickly. He was apprehended quickly. I believe she put some, the testimony is she put some of this bait money, which is stacks of 20s that have some sort of device, that alert device, in very short course, the police were notified. I don't believe there was any testimony about a panic button being used at that time, but the police were alerted very quickly.
So hypothetically, I go to a bank and I there's always 10 people in line in front of me. I don't know why. There's always 10 people in front of me. And I just want to get my own money out. And no, I would never do this. But if someone was exasperated and said, I want my money, I've been here for an hour, I mean, they could be, I'm just saying how these gestures could be misinterpreted or by the quote-unquote victim.
And I would submit, Your Honor, if you were wearing a somewhat outlandish disguise, that would...
That might be the way I always dress, but I'm
probably, and of course the question here is, could a rational trier of fact have found that the actions of the appellant, taken in total, what he was wearing, the note,
And that's the real question, what the trier of fact found, because you could have someone approach someone who's blind and produce a weapon and demand money from the person who's blind, doesn't know they have a weapon, but they threaten the immediate use of force. So the finder of fact would have to determine whether that was a threatened immediate use of force, not necessarily the victim having to determine that.
Certainly, and in fact, we did cite the Leibarger case, among others, and counsel referred to it, where the individual had a hand in his pocket. Now, there was no evidence that the appellant had his hands in his pocket here, but in Leibarger, there was no evidence either. He had his hand in his pocket, but there was no evidence he was making any gestures or any type of feigning of a weapon. There was testimony here, and the transcript, the teller testified on at least two occasions that she wasn't sure whether or not she was fearful what would happen if she didn't comply. He was wearing bulky clothing. She did not know whether or not he had a weapon.
So is that enough?
In total.
No, without the slamming on the fist, that because someone has bulky clothing and the person is apprehensive that they might do something in the future?
I think obviously it's not this case, it would be a much closer case, but in this case, of course, we do have the hand slam, we do have the note, or the yelling.
You use the term yelling and shouting, but I notice in your brief you say raise your voice. What was the evidence? Was there evidence that was yelling and shouting, or was it evidence he raised his voice?
Raising of the voice,
I believe. Because you can raise your voice and not be yelling or shouting.
And I suppose, it depends on, what the tone was at the beginning, and I think it's logical to assume that all his actions were ultimately he was not successful, fortunately, in achieving these ill-gotten gains, but he was not going to, he was going to attempt to modulate his voice in such a way that it was going to attract a minimal amount of attention.
Now, the only thing he raised his voice and said was, "Get back here." Is that correct? It wasn't like he said four or five more sentences. That was the sum total?
Yes, I believe that was the extent of what he said.
Okay, and I want to get back to the answer you gave to Judge Draper's question. So you agree then with your opponent that in light of the new statute, we're not looking anymore at what the victim's feelings were. We're looking at the defendant's actions and whether those actions constituted threatening of using immediate force, physical force. That's what we're looking at now.
We're looking at that, but I want to be careful here, because certainly the victim's reactions are not insignificant. And I think almost without fail, any time there is a threat of immediate physical force, you're going to have fear. So certainly the fact that there is testimony that I felt fear, I felt threatened, I think that's certainly relevant.
But any time you have a confrontation where someone is stealing something from you, it seems like objectively you would be fearful. You would be fearful because you're concerned something more could happen. And so, as you said, if someone comes in wearing bulky clothes, you might be fearful they would have a gun or they would have a knife or something. Simply because you're apprehensive, that doesn't seem to fall because of this encounter. We all know some encounters go bad and someone's killed, some don't. Is that what they're, because you're put in fear of in a robbery circumstance, that's enough to be guilty?
Not a robbery in the second degree, Your Honor, and again, the totality.
I'm sorry, go ahead and finish.
The totality of circumstances, you know, if you view these individual acts, they may not be sufficient. But of course, we don't do that. We look at the entirety of the evidence presented to the trier of fact. In this case, it was a Judge Stride case.
Is there robbery in the second talks about the use of force. It doesn't talk about the use of force to hurt somebody, right? The use of force to steal.
And in this case, the state's position was, as the appellant threatened the immediate use of physical force. And mm-hmm. In fact, many of the cases.
The use of physical force to hurt them or to steal. Am I right? First degree is when there's a weapon or a suggestion of a weapon. Second degree is where there's threat of immediate force, right? And stealing is you just steal.
And so as I pointed out, that could involve coercion, but it does not involve the immediate threat of physical force.
Yeah, so my question is, does this use of force have to be force that will hurt me or force that will just result in me losing my property?
I think what Judge Fisher is getting at is the statute says that it's physical force upon another person for the purpose of preventing or overcoming resistance or compelling the owner to give up the property. Now, it's not to hurt or injure them, it's to overcome resistance or compel them to turn over the property.
I think that's an excellent point, Your Honor, and I think the hand slam, you know, whether it's interpreted as him forcefully using physical force to do something other than physical harm to the individual, it may be indeed a broader question.
But the statute says uses or threatens the immediate use of physical force upon another person. So it's not that you use physical force against the counter.
Right.
It's that you use or threaten the use of physical force upon a person.
And again, what we're talking about is a threat. And he conveyed a threat by slamming the hand and by raising his voice.
Can you address the use of the word immediate? Judge Breckenridge asked about that earlier, what that meant.
Obviously, under stealing can be accomplished through coercion. Immediate, you know, I'm not certainly a physicist, so, you know, time can be measured in infinitely small numbers. Would a reasonable person believe there would be immediate threat of physical force? For example, coercion.
Or is it his intent? Again, the subjective, objective, whose point of view? The victim's, what he intended, or is it what a reasonable victim would feel? I thought we'd gotten away from what the victim would believe.
Well, if the victim believes, if I may finish the question, Your Honor, if the victim believes that, and she, and it's hard to separate, if a victim believes there's the immediate threat of physical force, by definition, they are going to feel fear.
Right.
A normal person would. Fear in of itself.
But it's if the person threatens the immediate use of physical force, do we look at whether that was the intent or they knowingly did that, or do we look at a reasonable person would think they intended that, or a reasonable person would think the victim felt
certainly knowing, you know, the defendant has to knowingly do, he knowingly slapped the counter, and I think it was reasonable for the finder of fact to view his actions as knowing it would create the fear that there would be the immediate threat, that immediate use of physical force. So it really is inseparable.
To find he intended that as a threat, or
yes.
Her to take that as a threat.
Yes, yes.
But, and that's the point that Judge Draper made and Judge Smith intended it to be a threat. The mens rea of the defendant is key. We've had a number of cases. There was a case where a doctor's got, there was a statute say you're not supposed to say things that will offend someone else. And I think we decided the quality of offense by the quote-unquote victim is not related to, you have to watch that very carefully. You can't convict someone on that kind of grounds of freedom of speech. And there was another case, Biney case, where a priest did something that
affront or alarm.
Yeah, and then it was a close case, but they said, well, you know, that the circumstances were such that you can't look at the quote-unquote victims as much as the intent of the defendant.
Any more questions? Thank you,
Thank
counsel.
Thank you. We ask that the court affirm.
If I'm robbed by somebody in a different language, I don't know what they're saying. They just stick their hand out, but they threaten to slap me down if I don't give them my money. And I'm not really sure what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Can they be convicted of?
I think so. And your example earlier of the person robbing someone who couldn't see, I think that person would also be guilty if he pulls out the gun. So I think when looking at the acts of the defendant, yes, that person would be guilty, regardless of what the victim thought. I wanted to point this court's attention to page 49 of the transcript. There was talk about the raising of the voice. I just wanted to show the court where that language actually comes from. Miss Ibu, the victim in this case, or the main teller, testified my client kept his voice low the whole time. One of the other tellers, though, said, the only time I heard him actually raise his voice is when he slammed the counter and said, get back here. So that's the evidence in terms of the raising of the voice.
That could pass a note, which doesn't, you know, indicate him or draw attention to himself. You pass a note.
Sure, yeah. And I think the disguise on the note would show he wasn't trying to call attention to himself. I wanted to address briefly what he thought he would have to do to get the money, because I think it's common knowledge that bank tellers give over money at the request of the person stealing money from the bank. And in fact, that's what Ms. Ebau's testimony was this bank had that policy. That was also the testimony in State v. Coleman, that bank teller had that policy to give over money. So I think it's actually very likely defendants robbing a bank would not have to use force if they come in and take the actions that Mr. Brooks did in this case.
On the other hand, one can look at it that people only give over the money because they're worried what will happen if they don't. And that's why the bank has that policy, because they don't want anybody to get hurt. So maybe it takes very little to raise it to the immediate use of physical force or threatening that, because there's already so much of a threat inherent in the situation.
But that's not the way the statute is written. So I think under the old statute, that is appropriate to take into account. I think a statute could be written to take that into account. But this statute requires the threat of the immediate use of physical force. And State v. Patterson from the Western District.
Does the force have to be a force to hurt somebody, or can the force just be forced to take the property?
Well, it has to be force against a person. So I think it has to be enough force that you...
So if you snatch the purse, is that second degree?
State v. Tivis said it wasn't. And State v. Henderson said it wasn't. And Henderson, he grabbed money from the cash register and brushed the clerk's arm. And they said that wasn't enough right there. And I think, so State v. Patterson said there had to be an act beyond stealing. But I think Judge Breckenridge was making this point that, and if I may briefly conclude, that any situation with stealing can put a person in fear. But what separates stealing from robbery is that threat of the immediate use of force. So I'd ask this court to reverse Mr. Brooks' conviction.
Thank you, counsel. It better be taken under advisement.